system. As long as you have a green light, you're running free. When the yellow light comes on, begin to bring your argument to a close, and then when the red light appears, finish your sentence and stop. And I remind you that rebuttal is for rebuttal only. All right, we call the first case Acadia Insurance versus Hines et al., and we hear first from Mr. Coco.
Good morning, Your Honors. Lawrence Coco here on behalf of Hines County School District. Your Honor, we're here today on the district court's denial of coverage under two different insurance policies that were issued to Hines County. One, it was issued by the Ace American Insurance Company, and one was issued by the Acadia Insurance Company, and I'm going to take them in that order. Dealing first with the Ace American Insurance Policy.
Can you just give me kind of a broad overview of what the coverage plan here was? I mean, most entities have a CGL policy that covers liability to third persons, and then they have an employer's liability policy that covers comp and employer's liability to a certain extent. Now, what is this, what's your plan here?
This, as to the Ace American policy, this is an educator's liability policy. It covers all different types of claims against educators. It's got multiple different coverages, one for the educational institution, one for the educators themselves, one for employment practices liability. As it relates to this policy, here's what's not in dispute. What's not in dispute is whether or not there's cover. It falls within the coverage, whether it falls within the definition of a wrongful act, whether it falls within the definition of a claim or mental distress or bodily injuries. What is in dispute is whether or not the claims that are alleged by the plaintiffs and their allegations that a minor child was injured while attending a Hines County school is whether or not it falls within the definition of a wrongful employment practice. And the reason why that's important is because the Ace American policy excludes claims for bodily injuries, but it has an exception to that exclusion for mental distress arising out of a wrongful employment practice. The delineated wrongful employment practices that we're talking about in this case are negligent evaluation, and as it relates to the negligent evaluation, the negligent hiring, training, supervising, or retaining, or a violation of an individual's civil rights.
But aren't these claims under the ACE policy for coverage of claims asserted by employees, not students?
Your Honor, that is the rub under the Ace American policy, and what we would submit to the court is absolutely not. There is not a single provision in the Ace American policy that in any way defines a wrongful employment practice as a claim by an employee versus an employer, or limits the claims as to only employees versus employers. And Mississippi law is directly on point in this, is that any ambiguity as to an insurance contract is read to the benefit of the insured. Any exclusion is read to the benefit of the insured. And certainly in this case, where there's not a specific contractual language that limits wrongful employment practices to claims by employees versus employers, what ends up happening is the district court had to read into the Ace American policy this limitation, and it simply doesn't exist. For example, the district court and Ace American have cited to the fact that there's 14 delineated, enumerated wrongful employment practices. One of them is discrimination. One of them is sexual harassment. One of them is retaliation.
Well, you're focused on the negligent evaluation.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
And stay focused.
The reason why I bring them up is that in the instances of those enumerated ones, they were actually defined in the policy, and they were defined in the context of an employment relationship. The reason why that's important is, as to the other enumerated wrongful employment practices, there was no similar limitation on them. And as it relates to the negligent evaluation and the failure to retain, hire, and train, those are the allegations, and that's the claim that was at issue in this case. And those are the types of claims that would normally be brought by third parties against Hines County. In other words, Your Honor, you're not going to have a teacher, an employee, sue for negligently hiring me. You're not going to have a teacher sue for negligently retaining me or negligently supervising me. These are claims that are naturally going to be brought by students and parents against Hines County for negligently retaining a teacher, negligently hiring a teacher, negligently supervising a teacher.
Why wouldn't an employee bring a claim if they didn't get a promotion, say, because they were negligently evaluated?
Well, certainly that's one way to do it, but I think it's less likely to have them sue for negligently retaining them. I mean, you could see it run both ways. I'm not saying that these claims are preclude an employee from bringing something under the allegations.
Just about, it seems to me, logically, you know, maybe you could figure out an oddball claim on some of these detailed descriptive lists, but it seems like most all of them, if not all of them, are logically brought by employees.
Many of them absolutely are, Your Honors, but it's not an oddball situation because we have the case right here in front of the court where the plaintiffs absolutely sued Hinds County for the negligent evaluation, the negligent retention, training, supervision of this teacher. And this is a garden variety lawsuit where a little girl was hurt at the Hinds County School District, and this is the exact type of policy. It is a policy that covers educators. It is a policy that covers the educational institution. There's not a single provision in this policy that precludes claims by third parties against Hinds County. And in fact, Your Honors, we submitted materials to the district court in support of our, or in response to the motion for summary judgment and in support of our motion for declaratory relief, showing that this type of policy was actually marketed towards as providing coverage for third-party claims. In the actual materials that we submitted.
Point out one other thing to you, though.
Yes, Your Honor.
The list of damages, like front pay and back pay and all that, I mean, that also points toward a claim by employees.
The list of damages that would be enumerated in the wrongful employment practice, well, but not as it relates to a negligent evaluation claim and not as it relates to a violation of an individual's civil rights. And that's one other thing I would point to in the definition of number 14, which is as it relates to negligent evaluation, the failure to retain, train, supervise. It refers to a violation of an individual's civil rights. If they had wanted this policy to say to be limited to only employees, they would have used the word employees. But the fact that they used the word individual in defining number 14 as an individual civil rights, that makes very clear that those are third parties. It's not limited to employees. The plain import of the policy is such that it would absolutely cover claims that are being brought by in a situation like this, where a minor child is bringing a claim against the Hinds County School District. And again, I would point the court to the Mississippi law of interpretation, which says any doubt as to coverage or the complaint, those issues are read to the benefit of the insured. Any ambiguities in the policies, and at best it's an ambiguity, any ambiguity in the policy is read to the benefit of the insured. And under that, under Mississippi jurisprudence, given the fact that there's not a single provision in this insurance policy that limits claims as to only being claims by employees versus the employer, we would submit that the policy absolutely provides coverage. Again, Your Honors, yes, Your Honor.
Isn't the existence of the student-based discrimination and sexual harassment coverage endorsement, doesn't that negate your position that the students were covered under the policy if there has to be an endorsement?
Well, but that, I believe the endorsement you're talking about has to do with harassment. That's not what we're, that's not the claim that's being brought here. The claim is that's
right.
being brought against, is against.
But it specifies students, whereas if the students were covered under the general 16, 14, whatever you said, wrongful actions, you wouldn't need anything to specify. That's the only reference to students.
But, I would submit to the court that the fact that that's brought up in an endorsement, it certainly doesn't. There's nothing in the language itself of the contract, and that's what governs here. There's nothing in the contract that says the claims have to be brought by employees versus the employer. I mean, and the fact that there may be an endorsement out there that was or wasn't implicated, it has no impact on the fact that the contract itself does not have a provision that excludes claims by third parties. It simply doesn't have it in there. And we would submit that it was an error to read that provision into the contract.
So your claim of coverage is strictly for mental distress.
Yes, Your Honor. As it relates to this policy, the covered action would be the mental distress arising out of the wrongful employment practice.
I mean, isn't it strange that if you have if your policy is designed to cover injury to students, it would only cover mental distress? I mean, kids get hurt physically a lot more than they get mental distress from injuries.
Your Honor, those are the terms of the policy, and I think mental distress happens more often in a school than physical distress. I mean, the types of, and that's not to say physical injury certainly can't happen at a school, but when you're talking about a wrongful employment practice and that what a teacher could do to a student at the school, it certainly involves mental distress, and certainly when you're talking about a violation of someone's civil rights, and also in 14 enumerated is also emotional damages. I mean, it speaks specifically to emotional distress as it relates to negligent evaluation, the negligent hiring, training, supervision, emotional distress damages, and a violation of an individual's civil rights. It was specific.
I'm just in trying to figure out how these policies meshed. It seemed to me that this policy was basically, in other words, you've got your CGL that covers injury to third persons,
yes, sir,
bodily injury and mental distress and all that. And then you have this policy, it seemed to me, designed to cover wrongful firing, sex harassment, you know, claims that are commonly made in connection with employment practices. That would be the gap you would have in your coverage, it seems to me, between your CGL and your comp policy.
Your Honor, what I would just say is certainly this policy covers all the things that the court delineated, but it also covers wrongful employment practices that are inflicted on the general on the third parties. And again, Your Honors, in the marketing materials that we submitted to the court, it's marketed as a policy that applies to third parties, that covers third-party claims. And that was properly submitted to the court. Now, the court certainly disregarded that. We feel like it's, and we don't think those materials in any way change the terms of the policy. We feel like they are completely consistent with the terms of the policy.
And why would you have this policy to cover injury to students? If you've got a CGL, why would you have it?
Well, certainly, I mean, as it relates to the CGL policy that was at issue in this case, it did not cover mental distress. This policy does cover mental distress. We've got two different policies. The Acadia policy covers bodily injuries. This policy covers mental distress. That covers the gap. That's exactly why.
CGL doesn't cover mental
distress. It does not. Not under the Acadia policy. And if it pleases the court, I'd like to move towards the Acadia policy if it doesn't have any objection. As it relates to the Acadia policy, the issue there is bodily injuries arising out of accidental conduct. And again, that policy, mental distress isn't an issue. It's only bodily injuries arising out of accidental conduct. There's an exclusion for intentional conduct. There's an exclusion for abuse.
But the complaint and the amended complaint allege intentional abuse.
They do. We would submit they allege both, Your Honor. We would allege in the complaint, here's where it comes into play, is that there were several allegations of the little girl being dropped in a wheelchair on multiple occasions.
Well, there were two, but one was outside the parameter that's the time frame that's being sued on. The 2007, you can't really consider that.
Your Honor, I believe that wheelchair drop absolutely is part of the lawsuit because it was referenced in the discovery responses wherein Acadia asked, what instances are you talking about where the little girl was dropped out of the wheelchair? There were two instances that were discussed, one that was described by a woman named Gloria Terrell and one that was described by a woman named Lorena Mason, wherein there are bodily injuries that arose out of these wheelchair drops, and it was accidental conduct. And one thing I would like to focus on...
Well, the 2007, you really can't count because they're not claiming anything for 2007.
Your Honor,
the complaint and the amended complaint do not allege anything other than 2008 to 2009.
Your Honor, we would submit that in the discovery responses that they are, whether it's alleged in the complaint or not, we would submit that they are claiming damages for that conduct because it was brought up in response to Acadia's direct questioning as to what falls are you alleging as it relates.
They should have amended. You should have amended.
Your Honor, I think Mississippi jurisprudence says that certainly you look at, in looking at insurance coverage issues, all doubts are interpreted to the benefit of the insured. And in particular, you look at the complaint and facts developed during discovery, the insurance company can't be blind in terms of what's going on after the fact. Now, the Delta Pi, in other words, if facts occur outside of what occurs in the complaint and it implicates coverage, the insurance company has to provide coverage. What's important, though, is that when the complaint was filed, within 30 days there was a reservation of rights letter that was entered that indicated that they read the complaint as having these wheelchair drops that would be covered under the Acadia policies as potential accidental coverage. We would submit that under the Delta Pi case, once that duty to defend is established, there's nothing the Delta Pine case is clear that after that occurs, the facts are developed later in discovery, and the ultimate outcome of the case doesn't impact the duty to defend, which is broader than the duty to indemnify.
How does a reservation of rights letter be an admission of coverage?
Your Honor, it's not, I wouldn't go as far as say it's an admission of coverage, but it is evidence that the complaint raised the claims of bodily injury and accidental conduct implicating the duty to defend.
You can write the letter so you can look into it a little bit and decide.
That's correct, Your Honor. But we would submit that the problem with the way the district court required it is it put Hinds County in the impossible position of having to prove the plaintiff's claims against them to secure coverage. And that puts us in an impossible situation. And we would submit that the Delta Pine case stands for the proposition that we're not to be put in that position of having.
My understanding is Mississippi follows the eight corners rule. You look at the complaint and you look at the policy. And if the complaint alleges a liability that's covered by the policy, you have a duty to defend it. I mean, and you don't look outside that.
But, Your Honor, I believe that's true, but at the same time, there are a body of law that says that if there are other facts that come up after the complaint is filed that implicate coverage, then you do have a duty to defend. You're not just based on what the complaint says.
Tell me what case that is.
Now, I would submit to you that. That in the American Guarantee, it said, although the insurer normally bases its duty to defend on the facts alleged in the petition, it may also have a duty to defend if it knows of other facts that warrant coverage. That's an American Guarantee 237F3rd at 610. And so if the court determines, or if the insurance company determines that there are other facts, and we would submit to the court that notwithstanding we feel like it was an improper burden shifting, there was evidence before the court that showed that there were bodily injuries as a result of accidental coverage. You've got the complaint. You've got the reservation of rights letter. You've got the plaintiff filing.
Tell me what in the complaint demonstrated coverage. That's what I'm interested in.
Your Honor, the complaint specifically referred to the drops being occurring. The complaint specifically had negligence claims that were being raised against Hinds County School District. Then if you look at the motion for the declaratory relief, they specifically said that there was unintentional they were seeking bodily injuries from unintentional conduct. When you look at the discovery responses that were sent.
Can you refer to the complaint when you tell me that?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Where's the negligence in the complaint?
Well, in the First Amendment complaint, I believe the first and second counts in the First Amendment complaint had general negligence claims against Hinds County. And then in the
actual descriptions of the
negligence. Well, in that,
everything was, the claim was for abuse, which would be intentional.
Your Honor, I believe that on page 2 in the First Amendment complaint, they discussed the dropping of the little girl, and we would submit that the dropping of the little girl, as it's described in the reservation of rights letter, is accidental conduct that results.
That's what you need to look at, and the dropping of the little girl when she was physically removed from the wheelchair and dropped on the mat, that was intentional. And the evidence is that the person who did that said, "I'm not going to hurt my back." The other dropping, the tumping on the sidewalk, is outside the time frame. So,
Your Honor, I would submit to the court that in the discovery responses to Acadia's discovery requests, they indicated that there are two instances of
fault. Davis asked you about the complaint.
Well, Your Honor, there was in the complaint at page 3, there were allegations that the minor child was dropped, and that was also in the amended complaint at pages 1, 3, and page 17. There were also allegations in the complaint that the minor child continues to suffer bodily and physically and emotional harm at page 1. And in the amended complaint, it states that they're requesting compensatory damages for the physical and emotional injuries. There's also a general claim for negligence in both complaints, specifically in the amended complaint. I believe the first two counts deal with negligence. I believe that under, again, resolving all doubts to the benefit of the insured, I believe that if you look at the complaints, and you look at the policy of insurance, it provides a duty to defend. And again, as cited in the American Guarantee case, we believe that the facts that were developed thereafter only support even stronger that there was a negligence or an accidental occurrence that resulted in bodily injury. The narratives that were provided by Ms. Mason and Ms.
Look, we don't look at the outside evidence in deciding the duty to defend.
Well, Your Honor, here's the problem with that is that the district court admonished us for not going outside of the complaint. They said we didn't provide evidence to the court establishing jurisdiction, and that was the place where time when we were supposed to do so. And Your Honor, I would frankly disagree with what respectfully disagree with what the district court said was that we absolutely did provide evidence to the court of accidental conduct and bodily injury, and it was in response. And the evidence that we provided was evidence that was developed by Acadia to the plaintiffs trying to make the coverage determination. And in the discovery responses, they described the incident, and in the incident, it makes it very clear it's impossible. We would respectfully submit that it is very difficult to take the narrative that was provided and decide conclusively that that's intentional conduct. I would submit to the court that the conduct that was described is at best a fact issue as to whether the child was accidentally dropped in the wheelchair or intentionally. And in fact, the plaintiffs themselves, in response to the question, said we don't know whether it was intentional or unintentional.
Let me be clear. I mean, I agree. If the complaint, the relevant version of the complaint, alleged that the teacher dropped the student, I think that's something that you can talk about. Now, is that in the complaint that's relevant?
Yes, Your Honor. There is the specific allegation that the child was dropped in the complaint. I believe on page 3 of the amended complaint and on page 3 of the first amended complaint, there is the allegation that the child was dropped.
How many complaints did we have?
Two, Your Honor. There's two.
So in the last amended complaint, that allegation?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely, Your Honor.
That's part of the abuse allegation.
Well, Your Honor,
that's not a claim for negligence.
Your Honor, I would respectfully submit that if you read the complaint in the insurance contract, in resolving any doubts to the insured, we submit that it absolutely was a negligence claim and it was an accidental claim. And Your Honor, that was agreed, at least initially, in the reservation of rights letter. And there's been nothing that's changed. I mean, there's been nothing that's occurred since the complaint that precludes or establishes that there's any intentional conduct or abuse as it relates to the wheelchair drops. There's not anything that's come after that complaint or after that reservation of rights that would preclude there being an accidental claim for this child being injured as a result of the wheelchair drops. There's just nothing that's occurred since then that would preclude that. And so we would submit to the court that obviously there is accidental coverage, there's coverage under the bodily injury and the accidental conduct. The corporal punishment endorsement, I'll brief that unless the court has any questions. I'm just going to rely on my briefing. I'd like to talk very briefly as to our motion for leave to amend. We filed as it relates to Acadia. Very quickly, we felt like during the mediation that took place on June of 2012, there were liability monies available. That was made very clear to our Moeller counsel. However, at the mediation, coverage counsel took control of all those liability monies, creating a conflicted defense. And as a result of that, we asked the court for leave to file a motion to amend our counterclaims to include counterclaims for bad faith denial of insurance benefits and to a declaration to stop them from denying coverage. The district court essentially ruled that our claims were futile and based that on the fact that it did not feel like we could prove damages and also based on an erroneous finding that the only monies that were available at mediation were coverage monies. The district court incorrectly stated what our allegations were. Our allegations were that there were liability monies available. And as a result, we feel like the district court's improper assumption or incorrect assumption and the allegation that we couldn't prove damages, we're not required to prove anything on a motion for leave. All we're required to do is articulate viable claims under Rule 13 and 15, and we certainly felt like we articulated viable claims of a conflicted defense as we lay out in our briefing on the motion for leave to amend. And we feel like the court improperly denied our motion for leave to amend. As a result, based on all the arguments that I've made to the court, we would submit that under the Ace American policy, we certainly believe that there was a negligent evaluation and a failure to hire, train, and those claims are allowed and covered when they're brought by third parties against the educational institution. And under the Acadia policy, we believe there were bodily injuries arising out of accidental conduct. Thank you, Your Honor. I'll reserve some time for rebuttal unless y'all have any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Coco. All right, Ms. Milner for Acadia.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Karen Milner. I represent Acadia Insurance Company. Responding to some of the inquiries made by Judge Clement, In the amended complaint, the incident of the drop is discussed in paragraph 9 as well. It's the factual part of the amended complaint. At the conclusion of that paragraph, the plaintiff says this: the foregoing examples of abuse by Ms. Johnston against MLC are not exclusive. The plaintiff's allegations, the factual allegations, are what dictates our duty to defend. The plaintiff characterizes all of these as abuse.
I didn't see any authority that abuse necessarily has to be intentional. I mean, and I was thinking of all these instances you hear about somebody leaving a child in a hot car, and going in the store, forgetting the child, and the child is injured, and some of those people go to jail for child abuse. So, why can't abuse be negligent as well as intentional?
We believe it can, Your Honor, and that's why that abuse exclusion fits within the policy, requiring the occurrence, requiring the accident. And, Your Honor,
I thought the argument was that abuse was necessarily intentional and so therefore not accidental.
No, the exclusion is for abuse or molestation. If you fit within the exclusion, it's not covered. You first have to be an occurrence, which is an accident, and then the abuse takes it out of coverage.
So negligent abuse is excluded, you're saying?
Any type of abuse, Your Honor, and abuse is not defined in the policy. However, looking to the common law understanding of the term, it includes physical maltreatment, a corrupt practice or custom, improper or excessive use or treatment, or deceitful act. And we'd submit that all of the acts complained of in this case, Your Honor, fall squarely within the abuse.
Where is that exclusion?
The abuse exclusion in the policy. Court's indulgence. Page 567 of the record. There are two policies attached, so it's 567 or page 427 of the record. And it excludes damages arising out of the actual or threatened abuse or molestation by anyone of any person while in the care, custody, or control of any insured. It also excludes any type of negligent employment or supervision arising out of the abuse. And, Your Honor, if I may go to the amended complaint and discuss the factual allegations that the court inquired. Mississippi law dictates you don't look to the claims alleged. If you allege negligence, gross negligence, Mississippi does not look to the claims. They look to the factual allegations. In the amended complaint, Your Honors, this is what Ms. Coward alleges about Hinds County School District's conduct: that this teacher had dangerous propensities. She engaged in abusive conduct, dangerous conduct, illegal abuse. The school failed to investigate notices she was a danger to minors. She posed an unreasonable risk of harm to minors. She had a predatory nature, wrongful conduct. She engaged in assaults. She was this is significant. She was a foreseeable risk of child abuse and battery by this teacher. She engaged in a deliberate indifference and gross negligence, malice, egregious, callous, and grossly negligent. And, Your Honor, if we can look to the actual acts that occurred here, this court will see the abuse. In the complaint, this teacher, acting on behalf of Hinds County, the MLC, the minor in this case, is 13 years old. She's confined to a wheelchair. She has no use of her arms. This teacher sprayed her in the face with an aerosol can, told her she stunk, called her names, threw a ball at her and hit her in the face, grabbed her face and said, "I hate you. You make me sick." This is in the complaint. Your Honors, we submit that this abuse exclusion is intended to exclude coverage for this type of conduct. Your Honor, we got the complaint in, and we did issue a reservation of rights. And we did say in our reservation of rights that we're going to conduct additional investigation, but we're going to go ahead and provide you with your own attorney to allow us to do that. We did that. They were provided Mueller counsel. At that point, on behalf of Acadia, we moved to intervene into the underlying lawsuit. We wanted to do depositions. We wanted to do discovery. We wanted to confirm that all of this was really abuse. We propounded discovery. In response to discovery, which is Exhibit D to our motion for summary judgment, this is what the plaintiff says. This is page 648 of the record. Abuse and mistreatment are the causes of the injuries in this case.
Now, when we look for coverage, though, don't we look to the eight corners?
Yes, Your Honor. Under Texas law, it's a strict eight corners approach. Under Mississippi, under the Mavar Shrimp case, which is a Mississippi Supreme Court case, and this court has applied it in the QBE case dealing with the trench of the man where the trench caved in. It was a case out of here. The court will consider other facts to evaluate coverage.
The duty to defend, though?
The duty to defend, correct. If, for example, if the eight corners, if the complaint alleges, in Mavar Shrimp, for example, the plaintiff alleged that he was an employee. Well, that wouldn't be covered. The insurance company knew that he really wasn't an employee. And what Mavar Shrimp says, you can't turn a blind eye if you know facts that trigger coverage and just look right to the complaint. Now, Texas law, we'd submit there's a state court decision, the Calderon at a Texas Court of Appeals. This is what Texas law states. The duty to defend does not depend on what the facts are. It depends only on what the facts are alleged to be. So in Texas, it is the complaint, the policy, and you're not looking to anything else. In Mississippi, you can consider outside sources, which leads me to my next point. In Mississippi, when we file motions for summary judgment on the duty to defend, it gives the other side an opportunity to come forth with whatever you have to dispute, to counter that on a motion for summary judgment, come forth with it. That's why Mississippi courts, when they say you have no duty to defend, the case is over at that point.
Give me your best case for that.
Mississippi case?
Yeah.
The Lipscomb case, 75 Southern 3rd, 557. In that case, Your Honor.
75 F 3rd.
75 Southern 3rd, 557. That's a 2011 Mississippi Supreme Court case. In that case, the plaintiff was injured in a fire at a rental property, and the insured owned that rental property. So the plaintiff sued the insured. At that point, there was the insurance coverage for the rental property had some type of exclusion in there about using something for profit or for rental property. There was a deck action. The insured filed a deck action against his insurance company because he wanted coverage. The insurance company filed a motion for summary judgment based on the rental exclusion. In that case, the insurance company, somewhat like we did, went out and deposed the insured. They conducted discovery outside of the complaint. In that case, the Mississippi Supreme Court looked to the complaint, the policy, and the deposition and found there was no duty to defend. And Your Honors, in this court's decision of Woodward v. Acceptance, that was in April of this year, this court relied on Lipscomb and cited Lipscomb. And actually, in that case, Your Honors, it was actually a petition for rehearing. On judging the duty to defend, this court considered a Rimkus report, which was outside of the complaint. And the issue in that case was a timing issue on damages. This court considered the Rimkus report, which was outside of the complaint, in determining the duty to defend.
What's that case?
I'm sorry, Woodward v. Acceptance.
Sorry?
Your Honor, it's in my
brief. That's all right. I got it. It's in your brief?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. It's April 14th, 2014 of this year, Fifth Circuit case. So, Your Honor, we'd submit, and also the QBE case, which is from this court, that was a case where a man was injured when a trench caved in, and the issue was whether the professional services exclusion applied. And this court considered extrinsic facts, but did find that they were not sufficient to come outside the exclusion, and this court upheld a summary judgment.
But, of course, I guess that works both ways. If the insured has evidence that the wheelchair was dropped, they can use that to show that there is coverage, I assume.
They could, and they didn't in this case. And Your Honor, when we propounded discovery, we asked for, we were wanting to see, okay, Are they claiming this drop was an accident, or are they claiming this drop was part of the abuse? Because what we look to in Mississippi is what the plaintiff is alleging, the factual allegations. And, Your Honor, the plaintiff alleges that this was an example of abuse. Your Honor, in the QBE case from this court did say an insured cannot trigger the duty to defend by denying the allegations of a complaint. An insured cannot simply say that is not true. That was accident. You must come forth with evidence. In the Little case by this court, Your Honor, Little v. Liquid Air, summary judgment is appropriate where critical evidence is so weak or tenuous on an essential fact. And, Your Honor, when we conducted further investigation, we discussed the discovery. In February of 2012, the plaintiff filed a complaint for declaratory judgment. The plaintiff did. In there, again, described the teacher as abusive, threw a ball at her knowing she wouldn't catch it, struck her, yelled at her while tying her feet to the footrest. And, Your Honor, going back to the amended complaint, this is on pages 1240 and 1241 of the record, the plaintiff says the proximate cause of the plaintiff's injuries in this case were the dangerous propensities of the teacher.
What's your position on the 2007 incident where the wheelchair tumped over and the child fell out?
Your Honor,
if that's not included within the 2008-2009 parameters?
It is not, Your Honor. It is not in the complaint. In the discovery, we simply asked for these incidents that you're describing. They're not seeking recovery for that incident. It's not in the complaint. There's no allegation.
It was another teacher also, right? That was a different teacher?
Yes, I believe so, in the 2007 incident. And we haven't seen any evidence of any kind of attempt to recover for that. And again, we look to what the plaintiff is seeking recovery for.
Because that was negligence, not abuse.
The 2007 incident? In the discovery, they state that though those falls are examples of abuse, and they say that in the discovery. So anytime we asked about falls, the plaintiff states that these are within the abuse. The plaintiff has never said negligence. And, Your Honors, when we filed our motion for summary judgment, it was their duty at that point to move forward and to come forth with evidence of any accidental conduct, and they have failed to do so. The only evidence that they insist upon is the reservation of rights letter and also the Mason statement where she hurt her back. She dropped her on a mat and didn't feel like doing it right because she may hurt her back if she does so. There is nothing in the complaint, the discovery, the documents that point towards accidental conduct. And Mississippi law is clear, and this court has stated in QBE, you simply can't just deny something. You have to come forth with evidence.
You know, all the Mississippi cases I saw involving abuse involved intentional acts, such as pinching somebody or sexual abuse. I didn't see a negligent abuse case. I'm just not sure that Mississippi would consider negligent conduct as abuse.
Well, Your Honor, physical maltreatment is what we would consider if you're referring to the wheelchair incident.
Well, but what about just dropping the wheelchair? Just because you call it abuse doesn't make it intentional. And if abuse is really considered intentional conduct, it seems like there arguably that could be covered if it's not alleged to be intentional.
If it's alleged to be an accident, correct.
They allege negligence and then they allege the facts of the incident and they call it abuse, how does that necessarily make it intentional to come within, looks like the Mississippi case's idea of what abuse is?
Yes, Your Honor, it comes because we look to the allegations of the complaint and there are no allegations that this was an accident.
Well, there are general allegations that the injuries were caused by the negligence of the teacher, aren't they?
No, Your Honor. The only allegations...
We referred to Johnson's negligent and emotional abuse of the child. I saw that in the complaint.
Yes, physical and emotional abuse. But, Your Honor, in the amended complaint... My time is...
No, you can finish.
In the amended complaint, however, the plaintiff herself states that the proximate cause of the injuries was the abuse. And she said it again in discovery, and she said it again in her complaint.
How would we know that's intentional conduct that Mississippi would consider abuse?
We would submit that dropping, are you speaking of the 2007 incident or?
Whatever. Any incident.
Well, we look to the Omnibank and the Moulton case and the coverage case on dealing with what constitutes intentional and what constitutes accidental in determining whether something was intentional to fall within that exclusion.
But just calling something abuse doesn't necessarily mean it's intentional, does it?
Your Honor, we would submit that it could be intentional under the common known
definition. Well, it could be negligent too, couldn't it?
If it, Your Honor, I have not located a Mississippi case on that point.
Well, we saw the Mississippi cases I saw involving abuse were all intentional. I don't know if you've got one that's...
No, and I mean, neglect could be abuse. Like Your Honor gave the example of leaving a child in a car could be abuse. And
Or just not being careful and dropping a wheelchair could be abuse, I assume.
If it fits within the common known definition of abuse, we would submit that it was. However, it's our position there's no evidence of accidental conduct. There was another issue if the court, I know my time's up.
Thank you very much, Ms. Miller. Okay, Mr. Whitehead.
May it please the court, I'm Steve Whitehead for Ace American Insurance Company. The policy that Ace issued to the school district, Your Honors, is really what's a blended form policy. And it's modeled after a directors and officers policy. You'll see that in Insuring Agreement 1. It provides professional liability coverage, and it provides employment practices coverage and crisis management coverage. Those are the four insuring agreements. Because it's a blended policy of D&O and E&O, D&O and E&O policies never intend to cover bodily injury of any nature or mental anguish in most forms, which is why mental anguish and bodily injury are excluded in this form. The exclusion contains a carve-out, an exception to the exclusion, when it's a wrongful employment practice claim, as the court knows, a defined term, 14 subparts, very detailed. And looking at the wrongful employment practices definition, I would submit to the court you can only infer that it has to involve an employment relationship to fit within that definition. To get to the interpretation that the school district wants, they want to take a couple of words out of that very detailed definition and say that if there's a negligent evaluation of the teacher by the school district such that had they evaluated her properly, they would have fired her and she would not have been able to conduct this conduct, that constitutes a wrongful employment practice. And we submit that that's not a reasonable interpretation of the policy when you read it as a whole. The reason that mental anguish coverage is provided for wrongful employment practices, I think, is fairly logical. Most of your wrongful employment practices, although you may have a breach of contract or a wrongful termination, many of them are federal law based. You have the Title VII claims for discrimination. You have the ADEA, age employment, discrimination and age. You have the Disabilities Act. You have Section 1981. Each of those federal employment laws include as a measure of damages statutorily a component for mental anguish. They have caps that apply based on the size of the number of employees you have and whatnot. And so it's perfectly logical that in the employment termination, employment discrimination, employment harassment arena, that the policy is intended to provide coverage for those mental anguish damages which are part of the federal scheme. Aside from that, the policy, it seems clear to me that the policy does not intend to afford coverage for mental anguish. So looking at our position is, looking at the definition of wrongful employment practices, the very word of it that it's an employment practice. You read each of the subparts of that definition, It clearly applies in a situation where an employee is claiming they were improperly terminated, sexually harassed, and not a student or a non-employee.
Sure would have been clearer if they'd said claims by employees, wouldn't it?
Your Honor, I think the only inference that you can make, though, is that it has to involve an employment practice. And I understand the point, but it's a definition defining what employment practices, wrongful employment practices are. I would submit to the court, if you need to read under Mississippi law, read the policy as a whole and not in isolation. And if you do that, and Your Honor pointed out, if you look to the definition of damages, if you move to different parts of the policy and look at every place where wrongful employment practice is used, it seems clear that it involves an employment relationship. Damages, as Your Honor pointed, is at page 304 of the record, is defined that it defines certain categories of damages, but says if it's a wrongful employment practice, damages also include front pay, back pay, liquidated damages pursuant to the Age Discrimination Employment Act. Damages shall not include employment-related benefits, retirement benefits, vacation, sick day, etc. But it says that limitation does not include salary, wages, bonus, and commissions when it's a wrongful employment practice. In other words, clearly those your salaries, your front pay, your back pay, those sort of items are at issue in a wrongful employment practice claim, and the definition is amended to include it there. If you look to the exclusions on page 313 of the record, exclusion 4C, that's where you see wrongful employment practice as the carve-out for mental anguish coverage being provided for a wrongful employment practice. But if you turn to exclusion 4G on page 314, it's your classic insured versus insured exclusion, what you see in D&O policies and E&O policies. They don't intend to cover a claim by one insured versus another insured, except when it's a wrongful employment practice, because necessarily you're going to need to sue a co-employee, your supervisor. So in that sense, it allows that exclusion not to apply, but only applies it to counterclaims backed by the offending employee. If you turn to exclusion 4H on page 314 of the record, it's your classic breach of contract exclusion. A breach of contract is in every D&O and E&O policy. Again, it says it won't apply to a breach of contract, but it allows coverage for breach of contract if it's a wrongful employment claim, because the employee may necessarily have an employment contract with the employer. And finally, I would submit that in section 4U, which is on 316 of the record, a wrongful employment practice, it says solely with respect to claims arising out of a wrongful employment practice, and then it delineates all the things that are not covered in an employment discrimination or employment practice case, such as workers' comp benefits, disability benefits, unemployment compensation, etc. Fair Labor Standards Act, National Labor Relations Board. I mean, those are the sort of things that OSHA claims, they're just not covered when you have an EPL type suit. And so I think if the court reads that definition everywhere it appears in the policy, you can only come to the conclusion that there has to be an employment relationship for there to be a wrongful employment practice. Now, this policy does cover claims by students, clearly. It does not, but those type of claims are not employment claims. It has the endorsement that was referred to for the limited student-based discrimination claims. And that would be a student being harassed or discriminated by another student, and then the institution takes no action as a result of that. Even if you look at that endorsement, which would not apply in this situation, there's no coverage under that endorsement for mental anguish. Mental anguish only is afforded in the employment context, employee, applicant for employment, prospective employee, former employee, or current employee suing for wrongful employment actions. And to take the words out of that wrongful employment definition out of context, I just don't think the court can do. it's that simple in our sense. I don't think the claims in this case could not later be amended in our view, where it's ever going to be a situation where you could find coverage later under the policy, because we don't have the employment relationship. I mean, at least not to bring in coverage for bodily injury or mental anguish. So from that sense, it's clear from looking at the initial complaints, the amended complaint, the four corners of those complaints and the policy, there never was a duty to defend by ACE in this case.
You agree we can look at affidavits that are filed and to decide the duty to defend?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Can we look at the affidavits that were filed to decide whether there's a duty to defend?
In my view, you look at the four corners of the complaint and the policy. I guess you're referring to the... If I'm representing the insurance company, I'm going to look at what's in the pleading. You could look outside to find an obligation to defend, but not to find an reason to deny.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Coco, back to you.
I want to follow up with what Mr. Whitehead said, that you can look to the complaint for an obligation to defend, but not outside of it for an obligation to deny. And I want to go back to the American Guarantee case.
I understand that. I mean,
well, Your Honor, that you can look to the complaint for a duty to defend, but you can't look outside the complaint at facts that are developed later to later deny coverage. In other words, once the duty to defend is established, the ultimate outcome of the case is not determinative. But
what case later?
What I'm describing first was the Delta Pine case, wherein it said the ultimate outcome of the case does not eliminate coverage. And Delta Pine's 530 F3rd, and it's at 402 that I'm describing, Your Honor. In addition to that, the American Guarantee case says, although an insurer normally bases its duty to defend on the facts alleged in the petition, it may also have a duty to defend if it knows of other facts that warrant coverage. In other words, there are other things that happen outside the complaint can implicate coverage. Now, what I'd like to focus on as it relates to Acadia first is are the allegations as it relates to the wheelchair drops and as to whether or not it was accidental coverage. In the first amendment complaint at the record 1236, it says, upon information belief, officials of the school district were aware of the negligence and physical or emotional abuse to which MLC was subject to at the hands of Johnson. The negligence and physical and emotional dispute. Those are three different things that are occurring there.
Characterized it all as abuse. Now, why doesn't that fall under that abuse exclusion?
Your Honor, I would submit that they're describing it as negligence and emotional disputes. In other words, I think there's two different things that are occurring there. It's not all or nothing. It's two different things that are...
Different kinds of abuse.
Well, or just two different kinds of action. I would submit that the accidental wheelchair drops are not abuse and that they're accidental conduct, but certainly, and so that they wouldn't fall within the abuse exclusion.
Well, that provision that your opponent read, characterizing all that as abuse, sounded like you were trying to call it all abuse.
I would submit to the court that it's not all abuse, and that is borne out specifically by the discovery responses that Acadia propounded to the underlying plaintiff to find out whether or not there was coverage or not. And in specifically, they describe in detail what acts or omissions, if any, the defendants did to cause in whole or part MLC to be dropped. There are two instances that we're aware of.
But one was not by Teacher Johnston. All these allegations of abuse are against Johnston. The 2007, somebody else accidentally tumped over the wheelchair.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that it's abundantly clear from the discovery responses that it couldn't have been Johnston in 2007. But
no evidence it was. There's evidence it was someone else.
But certainly, Your Honor, but I would argue that the allegations in the complaint are more expansive. They don't have to be localized just to Johnston. Now, certainly, many of the allegations are Johnston, but the allegations to Hinds County are that they didn't have globally procedures, controls, evaluations in place to make sure mistreatment of this minor child wasn't occurring. I don't know that it's necessarily all of the allegations of the complaint are localized to Ms. Johnston. I believe that it's
the way it reads.
Your Honor, but I think it reads expansively enough to where it covers other employees of Hinds County. It's not just Ms. Johnson. And they specifically describe those two falls. And the actual fall itself, as Ms. Terrell stated, there was an incident where the minor child's wheelchair turned over on the sidewalk and the minor child fell to the ground. And Ms. Mason said, I did not see her drop the child on the mat, but by her response and the look on Ms. Johnson's face, the teacher additionally, and the look on the minor child's face, I know she didn't transfer her appropriately. That doesn't establish that abuse took place. That establishes that the child was tumped over in the wheelchair, an accidental fall that resulted in physical injuries. In response to the discovery responses.
That's what I was saying.
Your Honor?
Saying it doesn't, the wheelchair tumping doesn't establish abuse.
Correct, Your Honor.
And it's not included. It's not against Johnson, and it's not in the time frame. You can't keep ignoring the time frame.
The incident that I'm talking about that I just read was from Ms. Mason. That is absolutely within the time frame of 2009.
You mean when she was dropped on the mat intentionally?
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree that that's what the discovery response says. It never says she was dropped intentionally on the mat.
Well, the person who dropped her said, I wasn't going to hurt my back. In other words...
But Your Honor, that's a fact question. It doesn't conclusively establish. She didn't say, I meant to drop her on the mat. She said, I dropped her on the mat, but I'm not going to hurt my back to bend over. And in fact, the plaintiffs, when asked the question, said they said, we do not know whether the incident where MLC was dropped was intentional or not. The only information we have on the incident is what Gloria Terrell told us in 2007 and the statement of Lorena Mason in 2009. That's the statement that we have to base it on. That's what I just read to the court. And I would submit to the court that that is a fact question as to whether or not that's intentional or accidental. Now, as it relates to the Ace American policy, Your Honor, I would submit to the court that notwithstanding what counsel opposite said, and all the definitions that he read to the court, here's what's not in any of those definitions. There's not a single thing in those definitions that says it has to be brought by an employee versus an employer. In fact, in you, it lists all these different types of things that can't be wrongful employment practices. What it doesn't say, what is it does not exclude from wrongful employment practices are claims by third parties against the lawsuit. And the very language of the wrongful employment practice that we're talking about, hiring, retaining, training, supervising, those are claims in violation of an individual's civil rights. Those are claims that would naturally be brought by third parties, just like in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
Okay, that completes the docket for the day, and we'll be in recess until...